Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kinglin Zegler presiding. Her silence is commanded.
All right, go ahead and have a seat. Good morning. Justice Kurofsky is appearing by phone today. The rest of us are here. The first order of business this morning is 2104 in the matter of amending 48-299 and 938-299 regulating the use of restraints on children in juvenile court. The presenters that I have this morning are Judges Crivello, Mitchell, and Attorney Hirsch. Then I have speakers, Attorney Fredericks, Judge Donald, the Executive Director for the Galt Center, Marianne Scully, Jennifer Ginsburg, Sam Benedict, Kim Erkotterin. I got it. Good. And Judge Gonzalez. Is there anyone that I'm missing?
This is quite a group.
Yeah, of course it is. I meant missing that intends to present or speak. We want to include all of you at all times. But thank you for that, Justice Bradley. All right. If there is anyone who feels that they want to speak and maybe didn't have the opportunity, you can always notify the marshal and we can find a way to accommodate you and get you on the list, even if you're not presently on the list. There may be something you're just dying to tell us as the presenters miss it. So, okay, let's proceed this morning then with Judge Crivello first.
Good morning.
Morning.
Johann Wolfgang von Goethe stated, "If you treat an individual as he is, he will remain as he is. But if you treat him as if he were who he ought to be or could be, he will become what he ought to be or could be." Children react to how they are treated. If you treat a child with respect and dignity, then in turn they will treat you with respect and dignity. When this occurs, therapeutic jurisprudence may be employed. A court is able to engage the youth in a sincere and engaged interaction. There's a positive impact on the youth and hopefully a positive impact on their future. If brought in shackles, a different interaction occurs. The youth isn't paying so much attention to the words that are being said. The youth is paying more attention to the clank of the shackles, to the clank of the chains around their legs. They are not making the same eye contact. There is not the same interaction. They are struggling with the ability to converse with their own counsel. It's more difficult for the youth to feel heard. It's important to remember that we're talking about children. Their brains are developing, their self-worth is in formulation, their self-confidence is shaking. They're trying to figure out who they are and how they fit into society. If they see themselves as criminals and not as an integral part of society, then that is who they will emulate. There is universal agreement that shackling is stigmatizing, it's humiliating, and it's further traumatizing. The research has established that shackling can lead to exacerbated symptoms of PTSD, as well as exacerbating mental health issues. Simply stated, it harms children. Not only does it harm children, but the indiscriminate use of shackling as well is harmful to the goals of rehabilitation and the reduction of recidivism. We need to understand that the youth who come in front of us have a history of trauma. They also quite often have mental health symptoms. Research establishes that juveniles with past histories of trauma are more likely to feel unfairly treated in the juvenile justice system. And that is even more prevalent with our youth of color. And that's just our starting point. We are all aware that procedural justice is as important as substantive justice, and youth notice and care about how they're treated. Now, if we use indiscriminate use of restraints on every child, and every child is placed in shackles, then they will perceive their situation as being unfair. And if a youth holds the perception that they are not being treated fairly, they will not trust the court proceeding, which in turn will hurt the youth's rehabilitative efforts. Adolescents who perceive their involvement in the criminal justice system as fair have lower rates of recidivism. So we need youth to recognize their potential and what they have to give to society. And wrapping a child in chains does not further that mission. So if we want to change behavior to reduce recidivism and to encourage rehabilitation, judges need to change the perception of the youth in front of us. And we need to treat youth fairly. And fair is not a blanket policy that every child that comes in front of us is placed in shackles. We need to independently weigh each youth. And there should be no cookie-cutter approach where children are involved. Lastly, the discriminate use of shackling does not compromise court safety or security. The presumption in my jurisdiction is that children will appear in front of the court free of restraints, except when there are specific documented reasons to justify the use of restraints. Since implementation of our discriminate use of restraints policy and procedure, things have gone well in the Milwaukee County Children's Division. When restraints are warranted, a written request is submitted. A judicial determination is made based on an independent review of what is the least restrictive means to achieve order, decorum, and safety in our courtroom. Our policy, which was created with buy-in from all of our stakeholders, is working. It has decreased anxiety before hearings, during hearings, and after hearings for our youth. It has allowed for greater interaction between the court and the youth during the proceedings, and it has changed how youth view the proceedings. It's not logical or reasonable to oppose the indiscriminate use of restraints. And quite often the response to these jurisdictions where they do employ that is, why do you do that? And the response is pretty much, because that's how it's always been done. Well, now is the time for change. It is time to look at each youth as an individual. It is time to make a discretionary determination as to the circumstances of each particular youth. I urge you to follow best practices and to create a uniform court procedure regarding the use of restraints on children in the juvenile justice system. And isn't that what we would want if our own children were in that chair in that courtroom in front of us? And yet, aren't the children in those chairs our children? Because they're our future. And how we treat them today will affect their perspective of themselves and influence their future, and thereby influence the future of our society. So thank you.
Thank you. I've got a question for you, a couple of questions.
Go right ahead.
Thank you. Has Milwaukee Children's Court returned to in-person hearings?
So the judges are all in person in the courtroom. What we found in our child welfare side is that quite often our parents were being defaulted because they were not present in the courtroom. They had to go to work, and the choice was either showing for work or showing for court. Losing your job, losing your housing, or going to court. So our child welfare side, we are doing predominantly by Zoom unless a parent asks or a litigant asks to be in person. Our delinquency side, we are asking on every appearance if they would like to be present in the courtroom, and we have in-person hearings on a daily basis.
So when did Milwaukee Children's Court return to at least some in-person hearings during the pandemic?
So the blessing for Children's Court is that day one of the pandemic, we went to Zoom. So we don't have a backlog. So we have heavy caseloads, high levels of violence, full calendars, but we've been operational since day one of the pandemic. Our ability to go in person was in accordance with the Chief Judge's directives as to the date that we could actually have in-person hearings. And to be honest, my last 2 years are a bit of a blur, so I don't have a date specific for you. But the date that we had the opportunity to go in person, we made that available and had our people on site doing so.
I'm just trying to get a handle on how many hearings have involved youth that in the past might have been shackled. How much experience has Milwaukee Children's Court had with in-person hearings with children not in restraints?
It's a good question. I can tell you that our numbers are reduced for in-person hearings. So yesterday I handled delinquency matters, and I handled an afternoon of delinquency, and out of the four cases I heard, one of them was in person. So it's in a reduced amount of cases being brought before the court in person, but I think it still does exemplify that we haven't had problems.
And how would the hearing come about if, for example, detention staff or the sheriff's department thought that a child might present a safety risk in the courtroom? How would the detention staff or the sheriff's department be able to raise that issue and get a hearing before the judge? Would that go through a district attorney, or how would that come about?
So we've set up a policy and where all of the individuals who are involved with their youth on a daily basis have the ability to complete a form. And that form details if it's a present or impending danger, if it's a risk of flight, and the basis thereof. They put this into writing. Not only do our juvenile correction officers who are in the secure detention have the ability to draft that, or the human service workers, but also our bailiffs as well. They all have additional training to look at what they should be looking for, to see heightened responses, to see if there are issues. That form, once completed, goes up into the courtroom. It's disseminated to the attorneys for the state as well as for the defense. A hearing is held before the matter is called on the record. If a youth wishes to participate in the hearing, we'll set up a Zoom meeting immediately and bring the kid in on Zoom so they can hear the court's rationale as to what the court determines to be appropriate. The judge then, after evaluating the information provided, signs off in writing on the form documenting the least restrictive means to meet the need of maintaining the order and security in the courtroom.
I was kind of struck when I was reading through the materials. They were all in support of the petition, but what I didn't see was any of the sheriff's deputies associations or the district attorney's associations weigh in one way or the other. So do you know, have you had conversations? I mean, you collectively, maybe there's somebody else who can address it, but I'm just wondering if you have any sense of their feelings about the petition and the proposed rule change.
I'm happy to weigh in, of course.
I'm sure.
So if you actually, in the petition under the Milwaukee County provision, you'll actually see a quote from our sheriff, Ernell Lucas. When we were creating this program, or creating the discriminate use of restraints policy, the sheriff's department immediately came to the table, and they immediately said, we understand that this is how things should be done, and we are willing to buy in and proceed in this fashion. Let's just make sure we do it within the confines of safety. So our sheriff from Milwaukee County is fully on board and embracing it, and there's even a quote in the policy from him.
So was there participation, though, by the sheriff's deputies and the bailiffs who are actually in the courtrooms and have that experience?
So at the table of the stakeholders were the captains and the sheriff. Following that, the bailiffs in the courtroom, they as well have the ability to annotate the forms and to provide input if they see anything. Oh, and a further point, if during the hearing something transforms from a reason not to have restraints to a reason to have restraints, our policy gives the sheriff the ability to move in and to change the protocol, because their job is to protect the safety of the courtroom. But the bailiffs that come before me, I'll talk with them about it, and I ask the kids about it as well that come into court what they think about it. And what they tell me is they understand it and they appreciate it, and if that was their kid in the courtroom, this is how they would want it to be.
I'm just asking because I remember from my days at Children's Court in Milwaukee County having a conversation with one of the sheriff's deputies who was planning to retire early because she said, I'm getting too old to handle these kids. So I wanted to make sure that the sheriff's deputies, the bailiffs who are on the ground in the courtroom, had the ability to weigh in and provide input into the process. So thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
All right.
I just have one question, too. When everybody agrees on something, it's either because it's obviously correct or because there's too much groupthink and people aren't missing something. So my question to you is, what's the best argument against your position? Because I didn't see it in the materials, and I want to make sure we're just thinking through around it. And then why is it, you know, you feel free to respond to why you don't think it holds water.
Well, I'm going to start with this obviously correct. I'd start there. The greatest argument opposing would be, sorry about this, but my greatest argument opposing would be safety. Well, we don't have problems if we shackle every kid. If we chain every kid to the floor, they're not going to be able to have an uprising. Everything will be controlled. But that's not the goal of Chapter 938. That's not the goal of juvenile justice, and that's not how we should treat our children. So if you want to balance safety versus justice and weigh safety as greater, then I guess we should shackle every kid. But that's not justice in my eyes.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Next up, I think it's Judge Mitchell.
Good morning, Justices.
Good morning.
My name is Judge Everett Mitchell. I am the presiding judge of our juvenile division here in Dane County, and I'm honored to be here this morning to support the petition that is before you, that you said no one has any opposition to, at least of yet. So Frederick Douglass wrote, it is easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. As I was reflecting on Douglass's quote almost 6 years ago, I started reviewing a crossover case of one of my kids. Her profile was long because she had a child. She was a child in the child welfare system due to the abuse of her father and the death of her mother. But since her trauma was not addressed, she began acting out and began to be charged with juvenile delinquency. I took the bench. The bailiff brought this young girl in dressed in typical green criminal outfit into the courtroom in handcuffs and a belt restraint. I immediately noticed the demeanor of this child was broken. She hung her head down, made no eye contact with me, as if she was completely invisible to us. As we went through the entire hearing, she never lifted her head the one time. And when she needed to sign a form, she struggled to lift her little hands to be able to sign the form we needed her to sign. So I looked at my bailiff and I said to the bailiff, go ahead and remove the restraints off of her. Immediately the courtroom went silent, and all we could hear was the clanging of these chains that were being taken off this young girl. But I saw her lift her head up immediately. For the first time in that hearing, she looked at me. She signed the form. She spoke to her attorney. We concluded the hearing, and she went back through the door, going back to the juvenile detention center. Everybody was safe, and this young girl was white. After this hearing, I started to pay attention to all the ways and conditions in which children were being brought into my courtroom in handcuffs and restraints. I am very intentional when I use the term children because various systems have a temptation to turn children, especially children of color, into super predators. I immediately started to witness a pattern of my traumatized black, brown, and white children consistently brought from the detention center to the courtroom under the presumption that they needed to be restrained in order to participate in the hearing. After watching this carousel of inequity and imbalance in the lives of our children, many of whom experienced horrific traumas and events as children, I decided our court system needed to demonstrate fairness and justice by choosing to believe in these children's ability to behave in a way that eliminated the need for them to be restrained during their court hearing, and hopefully empowering them to have the power returned back to their voices. In Dane County, with the support of our retired presiding judge, Judge Shelley Gaylord, I chaired the committee to change the presumption so that judges could have a process to remove restraints from children in our juvenile court proceedings. Initially, you can imagine the tensions were very thick because safety, as Judge Gravella talked about, is generally left to the bailiffs to determine in that moment. But I firmly believed then, as I do now, justice and fairness is the judge's role in his or her courtroom to define what that looks like. While there were many reasons given to maintain the status quo of juveniles who come from detention for whatever reason should come into the courtroom in handcuffs, I reminded the group assembled there, including our bailiffs, including our DAs, our public defenders, our workers, that these are our children, our children, and they deserve the opportunity to be seen as children and not many adult criminals. Many of these children experience traumas of sexual and physical abuse, neglect, abandonment, and untreated mental health. And I told them the court cannot become another co-participant or co-conspirator in increasing the trauma and harm caused to these children. Rather, as Maya Angelou said, I encourage our partners to remember that each child belongs to all of us, and they will bring us a tomorrow in direct relation to the responsibility we have shown them. In an agreement, we shifted the presumption away from the default of being brought in shackles to one that assumed they would come to court without the need for handcuffs or restraints. We established a procedure that allowed multiple stakeholders to have input. The detention staff gave input on their behavior and specific levels while they were there. In Dane County, we have a levels from 1 to 4. And if they were on a 1, that didn't look good for them. But if they were maintaining a 4 in detention, that looked pretty good for the kid. The bailiff discussed the juvenile's behavior en route to the hearing. So we realized that safety was not about just a courtroom. Safety was a continuum of care. So our bailiffs that brought them over from detention was having a conversation with them about what their expectations were when they come. The state gave input, and the defense attorney provided his or her comments And ultimately, the decision was going to be left to the judge's discretion as to whether or not they would take off the restraints or would keep them on during the hearing. Dane County adopted this presumption over 5 years ago. Since then, judges and court commissioners have conducted thousands of hearings without handcuffs or restraints. Neither the safety of our courts, our staff, nor our children have been compromised. At this stage, the presumption is so well ingrained into our culture now that parties assume we have always done this for our children this way. Young people are engaged. Young people are vocal. Sometimes I don't always want to hear what they have to say, but they're vocal. They're thoughtful. They're angry, but respectful. And they leave the courtroom hopeful. I'll conclude with this quote from Brian Stevenson. He said, "Finally, I've come to believe that the true measure of our commitment to justice, the character of our society, our commitment to the rule of law, fairness, and equality cannot be measured how we treat the rich, the powerful, the privileged, and the respected among us. The true measure of our character is how we treat the poor, the disfavored, the accused, the incarcerated, and the condemned. We are all impacted when we allow other people to be mistreated, our children included. I support this petition and urge you to do so because this change in presumption will provide all children in our state with the same presumption that they can be seen, that they can be treated fairly, and regardless of the outcome, feel like justice in Wisconsin is completely possible. Whether that child lives in Jefferson or Kenosha or Grant or Brown or Rock or Door or Douglas or Fond du Lac or Oneida, he or she will be given the opportunity to participate in a hearing about them and their best interests with the presumption that they are a Wisconsin child. And in Wisconsin, we take care of our children. It is in my humblest opinion that if we want a Wisconsin that works for all of us, then we need to start with the least of these, our traumatized children, in hopes that the seed of love, in hopes that the seed of justice that we plant will one day blossom into tomorrow that is filled with fields of hopes that will one day be realized. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I just ask a quick question? You piqued my interest when you asked about in-person hearings in Milwaukee. I think we should ask the same of Dane, since you are a larger county as well.
Yeah, we've been back since we were given directive to be back in person. So we do hybrids, though. So in Dane County, we have a continuum. So we have child welfare and JV cases in our courts. So we do hybrid cases where we do pleas, and if pleas and dispositions are in person, any other kind of status hearings we may do via Zoom. But we have been operating back in person for over a year now. So, and we do both those who come from detention as well as our court commissioner who sees our initial pleas also in person.
So you may have had more experience then with the new way of unshackling, right?
Yes, ma'am. We've been, we've been doing it for over 5 years. So when we first started the procedure, we started, with very limited, interactions. But of the four courts that see the juvenile cases, we have really been practicing this. As I said in my comments, it's almost like it's natural. So at this point, people assume that presumption and they work. But initially, we went through the stages that, like Milwaukee County, there was a form. The form was filled out both our bailiff, our DA had some input, as well as our detention workers. And we really did try to work together to make sure that we had this. The hope was that the young person would not have to hear another negative thing, that they would have to prove that they are worthy of this, rather starting with the assumption that they are worthy. But if they're not conducting themselves in a way that gives the judge as well as the bailiff's ability to present that evidence to the judge so that he or she can make a decision that's in the best interest of the child, but also for the safety of those present.
Yeah, I'm just, because you seem like you're kind of the pilot project, really, for this rule, or maybe I see Judge Gonzalez saying maybe La Crosse had a hand in that.
Well,
I'm not trying to pick a fight here. I'm just trying to figure out, is this rule has it had the benefit of the experience of other counties who've been doing this for a while?
Yes.
This isn't the beginning. This is a product that has been working and works well. You fine-tuned it.
Yes, and I think, we had La Crosse. You've had smaller counties who do this already. I think you needed to have some evidence from bigger counties like Dane and Milwaukee who process, cases, a lot of cases, and have a lot of experience working both with our bailiffs as long as with our DAs as well as our public defense, all because we, had to be brought. But, again, it took 5 years for us to get the data we necessary. And I can tell you that after doing this for 5 years, that when we talk about have we had incidences in our entire court system that we feel uncomfortable with, we've had zero incidences in the 5 years since we've been doing this.
I'm actually beginning to feel sorry for all the other people who are coming after you because I don't know what they're going to have left to say. But don't feel like you have to say something. Thank you for answering my questions.
Chief Justice Ziegler, can I pipe in for just 1 second?
Yes. Justice Crossey?
Thank you. Judge Mitchell and Judge Crivello and everyone else who's going to speak today, thank you. Judge Mitchell, I just wanted to especially thank you because I know that you have been on the forefront of this issue, as you said, for 6 years. I'm noting in some of the material that was presented to us that it looks to me like in addition to the experience that you have had in Dane County and that Judge Crivello talked about in Milwaukee County, that there are a number of states who also have gone this route. According to the material I'm looking at that was submitted, it looks like 14 state Supreme Courts have elected to regulate juvenile shackling by court rule. There are 12 states that have barred juvenile shackling by legislation, and there are another 8 that have used various types of admin rules, policy, and court decisions. So in addition, it seems, to the experience that you have had and Judge Crivello has had in Milwaukee, and I'm assuming Judge Gonzalez is going to talk about the experience in La Crosse, that 14 plus 12 plus 8 equals, I think that is 34 states have also gone this route. And I'm just wondering if you have any information from those jurisdictions as to the amount of success that they have had as well. Thank you.
I will say that our next speaker will probably have all of the data from those other states. I will say I've been so focused on Dane County, Wisconsin, that I really haven't looked anywhere else. So if we get it here, I think we'll set the record for what we need for our state. And I'll let my other colleagues be able to speak to the rest of those issues.
I guess there is something left to say then.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Attorney Hirsch.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Eileen Hirsch. I am, as Justice Bradley mentioned, like one of those old ladies who had to get out of the business, but I was a public defender for many years. I represented juveniles. That was my specialty in the public defender's office, and I did have a lot of experience with kids being shackled in court. So as you know, it's difficult to follow Judge Crivello and Judge Mitchell, but I think I'd like to start with Justice Hagedorn's question. I became involved with this. I volunteered to work on this in my retirement because I cared about the impact on kids. I had seen it. I had read the research on it. I had heard from other people about it, and that was my concern. What struck me as I researched this issue and began to draft the memo in support of the petition are two things. One is I could not find another side. I could not find any argument that was being made in research or the literature. There were general thoughts from sheriffs. I mean, we all heard through the grapevine that there were sheriffs who opposed it because they thought it was safer to shackle everybody. But there was nothing, no research I could find. I also called the campaign for the against indiscriminate juvenile shackling, which was part of the National Juvenile Defender Center, which has now been branded the Galt Center. And Marianne Scally, the director of the Galt Center, is here and who is very familiar with the national move on this. They've done national research. We've asked everywhere in Wisconsin. We've been unable to find an instance of safety being threatened by a child being unshackled in court. And we simply can't find that opposite argument. But I think what I can add to this discussion today is that when I began researching, what really struck me as I went through the research has been mentioned today, but I want to put this in the context. The fact is that indiscriminate shackling in juvenile court harms the court system as much as it harms the child. I believe that completely because there's several reasons for that. One is that, as both the judges talked about and Judge Schumacher in Eau Claire talked about, Judge O'Neill in Marathon County talked about, they both offered comments that when they have a child not shackled in court, their interaction with that child is very much improved over a shackled child. They feel like the children are more engaged, they are more expressive, and they're more able to understand what the court is saying to them. And parents and family also have that ability, really, to understand better what's happening in court, which is important because, of course, they help the child figure out what was said in court and what that means to them later. The other point, and this goes somewhat to children, but I think it goes to the court, too. I should tell you that Dr. Coffey is here. She wrote the affidavit of, it's attached to the memo and support affidavit A. Dr. Coffey and her student, Odile Roddick, are here. They'll answer questions, but they didn't sign up to speak in consideration of the court's time. So if you have questions specifically about that, Dr. Coffey will be willing to answer those questions. As she said in her affidavit, there's two characteristics of adolescence that are really important here. One is that children are forming their own identities at this point. We think we've all seen this with teenagers. My kids would go to school one day as goth, and then they'd come home the next day as cheerleaders. They're working on identity formation, and they are really conscious of how they're seen by others. They always think people are looking at them and judging them. So when they are brought into a courtroom in shackles, they are conscious, and they believe that the court is seeing them as criminals who are dangerous and have to be shackled. And there's a danger in that, and there's a very severe danger in that because they're beginning to form identity. They may think, maybe that's what I am, and try out that identity and go out and commit crimes in keeping with their new identity. That has happened. The other thing that happens, and I think this is even more important, is that they feel like they are presumed guilty. You put them in shackles, you bring them into the courtroom, we tell them they're presumed innocent, but it's a case of actions speaking louder than words. The presumption that comes from being shackled is that person, that court, thinks I'm guilty and dangerous and need to be shackled to be kept away from others. That, of course, means that they can't get a fair shake in the court. And we know from research, both Professor Klingel mentioned it in her comments and Dr. Coffey mentioned it in her comments, that children and adults who believe they were not treated fairly in court will have a higher rate of recidivism after court. The Child Welfare League of America commented, shackling doesn't protect communities, it harms them. The other thought, I really thought about the effect on the justice system as I was working through this. And the other thought is the U.S. Supreme Court's versus Allen, that shackling is an affront to the very dignity and decorum of judicial proceedings. If we want the respect of the public, and we do as a court system, the court needs to act respectfully toward the people who are in court. And I once observed, and I know we all tell our little stories, but this was very interesting. I was in Arizona observing a juvenile court one day, and they brought in a 15-year-old boy. He was coming in for a hearing because he had completed a short-term dispositional program in the detention center of the courthouse. And he had asked his parents, and there was a joint recommendation from all of the involved parties that he be released that day to go home. He'd asked his parents to bring a suit to court, to him in the detention center, because he wanted to come into court and show the judge that he had respect for the court and respect for the process. They brought him in a suit with shackles around his legs, handcuffs around his wrists, a belly chain around his suit coat, shackled. As an observer sitting near that family, I felt like it was a tragedy. I felt like this child came in with a show of respect, and the court did not return that respect. It did not respect his dignity. It did not respect his completion of the dispositional program. Now, the court said it did, but and I knew, of course, that it was the detention center policy, not the court's policy. But in that courtroom, it felt like the court was not respecting what he had accomplished or who he was as a person. I thought the Illinois Supreme Court said it correctly in In re Staley when it said that indiscriminate shackling demeans the justice system. I think that's important to the court, and I'm stressing that today because I believe that's why this court needs to take on this issue. If we were only talking about harm to children, we could go to the legislature, we could ask the executive, we could ask anybody to take on that harm. But when there is a practice, a widespread practice in Wisconsin that harms the integrity and the effectiveness of the juvenile court system, this court is the body that's appropriate to address that problem. So I just want to, another part of this, I just want to tell you that in addition to Judge Mitchell, who's had this in policy since 2016, Judge Gonzalez will tell you that she's had this policy for a very long time. Eau Claire has also had this policy since 2016. So there's a lot of experience with it here in the state of Wisconsin. I know that Ms. Scally will tell you about the experience around the country. In 2020, and I actually came back in about 2015 or 2016 from a national conference and started making motions to remove shackles from my clients. That was how I thought I would address it. But in 2020, the State Public Defender's Office used their offices and called around the state to take a survey of what the shackling practices were in each county. And it comes from the State Public Defender staff. But basically what we found is about half of the counties rarely shackle in court. About 25 counties, however, many of them sizable, medium-sized counties, indiscriminately shackle every child who comes from the secure detention center to court. We quoted somebody in here saying that they basically what they've been told, and I think this is the real argument against it, is we've never done it that way. We've always done it this way. And that's really the main argument, I think, against the change to policy. It's hard to make changes. Really importantly, I think, that in 8 counties, the sheriff's department still calls the shots. Now, in State versus Grinder in 1995, this court held in an adult criminal case that the trial court erred when it relied on the sheriff's policy in making a decision that the defendant in a criminal case should be shackled in court. They said that the trial court is responsible for courtroom security and safety, and this court has routinely agreed with that decision. That the trial court is responsible for security and safety, should not turn that decision over to the sheriff, and should make the decision based on the circumstances, the individual circumstances of the case. Yet we have 8 counties where the sheriffs are still making that decision in Wisconsin. I can also tell you that in Wisconsin, the practices vary from handcuffs only, and I think it's in Jefferson County, there's handcuffs only, and the neighboring Rock County, there's leg shackles only. And I'm pretty sure that's not based on the fact that every child in Jefferson County is likely to do something with their hands, and every child in Rock County is likely to run out of the courtroom. There are counties where they use belly chains, there's counties where they don't, they use all different kinds of shackles, and I think it just belies the fact that there is no research-based, no experience-based reason for any kind of shackles. We've also learned, and Judge Mitchell has said this, but in our research around the state, as I've looked into this, I've talked to judges and people and public defenders from around the state, we have not had any experiences of serious breaches of safety. You know, Eau Claire, as I say, has been doing it for 5 years, and everybody there mentioned one time when a child in the hallway, in Eau Claire, they actually have secure detention workers bring children through the public corridors into the courtroom. And one time in a hallway, a kid punched the wall. It had to be repaired. That was their only incident in Eau Claire over a 5-year period. So for all of these reasons, we think that it's important that this court enact a statewide rule to establish a single, widely known standard for juvenile court shackling decisions. Another issue we found is that people in one county, in some counties, don't know what the policy is, that there is no written policy. There's when I had a judge from St. Croix County call me and tell me, that chart's wrong, that's not our policy. And I believe it was true, but when I checked it with the public defender's office, they didn't know that policy. The other thing we learned is that policies change when judges change, that a successful policy had been in place in one county for several years, but when the judge retired, a new judge came in, the bailiff expressed fear of that a child might try to escape from the courtroom, and so now they use leg shackles. So that policies are changing, people don't know their policies well. I really believe that this is the right decision, the right solution here, is that there's a statewide rule, it goes into statute, the court does what it does in cases, it sets a general legal standard, and it leaves the specifics up to each county. So each county can take into accordance, they can come up with policies that deal with their, how they transport kids from court, from the detention center to court. They can take into account the circumstances of their courtroom. And they can take into account, in individual cases, the circumstances of that child and their current state of mind. I believe this is the right answer to that. Are there any questions? Any questions I haven't answered?
Yes.
Yes.
Attorney Hirsch, it's nice to see you, and thank you for staying involved, notwithstanding your retirement. For the record, I did not call you an old lady. I noted in the materials that you and Attorney Rondini, who I also see in the gallery, nice well, met with the leadership of the Badger Sheriff's Association to discuss the proposed rule. As I noted to Judge Carvello, I found it, it sort of stood out to me that the Sheriff's Association, none of them weighed in one way or the other. I guess I'm asking what your conversations were, what feedback you received from them, because while it is by law, by rule, the court's responsibility to maintain security in the court, of course, it isn't the judge who must react and deal with a situation in court that threatens the safety of the attorneys and others present in the courtroom. It is typically the Sheriff's Department responsibility to respond to that. So I'm very interested in hearing whatever information you can provide about what the Sheriff's response to this petition has been.
I'd be happy to. I do want to mention, though, because you reminded me of this, that every one of the five counties we describe in this, in the memorandum in support of the petition, this was a joint effort of coming up with their policies and procedures. In every county, the sheriffs were part of the decision to go forward with the limited shackling policy in their county. We, Diane Rondini and I, did meet with the four sheriffs who are the leadership of the Badger Sheriffs Association in August before we filed the petition. We wanted their input. They were sheriffs from Grant, Dodge, Dunn, and Marathon counties. Three of those counties are pretty small, and if you look at our chart, you'll see that they rarely shackle. We had a hour and a half discussion with them, and in the end, they told us that what they preferred was for counties to decide what their shackling policies would be by having input from local stakeholders. We, of course, believe that's exactly what we're asking this court to do, is to set a standard so that counties can then have input and actually determine their own policies from local stakeholders. We haven't heard from them from the sheriff since then. And based on our conversations, is that the sheriff's positions around Wisconsin are pretty much across the board, like their shackling policies are. That there are many sheriffs who are very comfortable and who actually have initiated no shackling policies or limited shackling policies in their counties. I think Manitowoc County has a shackling policy that's part of the sheriff's department policies. And so we think that there are a lot of sheriffs who are comfortable with this, who don't oppose it, and then some who want to do it the way they've always done it, and so that they really couldn't come up with a Badger Sheriff's Association policy. It was too much variation. That's our thought. But what they told us after the meeting was simply that they thought counties should decide. We, of course, don't want the court to walk away from this and say counties can just decide, because we think there are important legal standards and important effects on the court system that support having a statewide rule. But I think this rule is general enough that each county can come up with their own local policies. You also asked about the District Attorneys Association. Again, we contacted the District Attorneys Association. We sent them the petition. We asked for their input. The last thing we heard from them is that it was coming up at a meeting sometime in the fall, and then we didn't hear anything again. So mixed reaction from attorneys. We don't know from district attorneys.
From my perspective, it would have been nice to have a statement or even a presentation by some representative from the Sheriff's Department, because I can speak from my experience, again, at Children's Court of Milwaukee County. The Milwaukee Sheriff's Department really shared a lot of the ideals that have been mentioned during the presentation today, and in fact, many of the deputies that I observed had interactions with the children to some extent, even more than the judge and sometimes a lot more than the attorneys, as far as trying to counsel and mentor during the times that they spent with our children at Children's Court. So their input would have been, I think, important to hear. But thank you for sharing the information.
I can't make them respond to you.
I understand.
They were given notice. There is notice provided to
right.
Pretty much more than a single space page of people.
Right.
So
I want to say two more things. One is, in La Crosse County, I talked to Sergeant Penskover, who is the chief transportation officer for La Crosse County, and he was the chief transportation officer before they started not shackling kids and after they started not shackling kids. And he told me exactly what you said. He said, we know these kids. You know, we've had interactions with them over time, and we know them, and we're comfortable. You know, we have a good read on where they are, which is why the officers who do transport are usually people who can raise this issue with the court if they think that the child is volatile that day or likely to run or whatever. I have not met a trial judge who did not have great respect for the sheriff's deputies and the bailiffs that keep security in the courtroom. And I think that there is no question that they will be part of these policies in every county. I can't imagine a trial judge who would come in, and I've met trial judges all over the state, who would ever think of establishing a policy about courtroom security and safety without talking with their bailiffs, the transportation deputies, district attorneys, public defenders, et cetera. They have truly been group efforts in every county.
You've reminded me how good you are as an advocate and how much we miss you. So it's good to see you.
So I had a question first.
Okay. I just want to give the court as well as everyone else a heads up. We allotted an hour for this, and we are now at 55 minutes. And we have 7 speakers who would like to speak. Now, maybe, as I've been saying, there isn't a lot left to say, but assuming that we want to hear from people, people can assume that, you know, we have a lot of materials, and we reviewed that, which is good, and it's been very nice to hear from all of you, but I'm just letting my colleagues know that we do have other people on the next rule that are here, ready to go in about 5 minutes, and they're not going to go in 5 minutes, so I'm just giving you a heads up, too.
So I just want to thank you all for your presentations and for the work you put in, and I just want to also highlight, because there's been a lot of questions about wanting other people's comments, and I'm looking at the list of individuals and organizations to whom this proposed rule was sent, and it does include the Badgers Sheriff's Association, and it does include the deputy sheriffs, and it includes all kinds of other Wisconsin State Attorneys Association. I mean, on and on. It's pretty much 2 pages here, and yet we did not hear any response from them. They clearly could have made a comment if they'd wanted to, I assume.
I assumed so, too. I actually assumed that they would.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Okay. So we go forward here. Attorney
Eileen Fredericks.
And we all thank you. So you would receive 7 long thank yous from all of us. We appreciate your great work. You do wonderful work, and it's nice to see you here today. So,
yeah. I'm conscious of the time, so I promise to be very brief. Thank you so much for having me. I'm Eileen Fredericks. I'm a state public defender. I've been a public defender for almost 16 years. I've worked in Kenosha County, Milwaukee County, and Dane, and I currently work in Dane. And I just want to say how thrilled I am that the court is taking up this issue, first of all for our clients, but also for our attorneys, because, you know, for our clients, this is so important. You know, I've seen so many kids come into court. I've had so many conversations with kids before court about being shackled and how upsetting it is to them that that's happening and wanting to know why and what it means. And for a very long time, it was just because that's how it was done. And now I get to tell them that I think it's unlikely that they're going to be shackled, that they could be shackled. But if they're behaving in detention and doing what they need to do, then I'm not concerned at all. I really haven't seen a lot of issues in court at all. Even when kids were shackled, I think there was probably more issues even when kids were shackled. The time, I think I can remember maybe 1 or 2 times ever when we've had issues in court with kids acting out. And the one that's most clear in my mind is a kid who was not in custody and was taken into custody, which I think is, you know, a very upsetting situation. So I don't think that there really is that concern. I sit next to these kids and I'm face-to-face with them in the detention center. I sit next to them in court, and I don't want them to act out. I don't want them to affect the outcome of their cases. And so, you know, I wouldn't support this if I thought that they were going to do something that was going to compromise their situation. And I've seen these kids, some kids less than 100 pounds, you know, who can't even put their feet on the ground, and I've had to ask bailiffs, like, to lower their seat because they can't, like, use the, you know, their hands are shackled, so they can't lower their own seat to be able to reach the floor. So I really am just so thrilled that we are here today and that we might get this to happen, because we've been waiting a really long time. And that takes me just to the issue with our attorneys, is that I have worked to train our attorneys to ask for kids not to be shackled, because I've seen how impactful it is for them to be able to come to court without shackles. And it is very difficult to change what's happening county by county. You know, there's lawyers in our agency who do juvenile cases, mental health cases, criminal cases, you know, TPRs, all these different kinds of cases, and they get interested in this and they want to do it, but it's hard to get the attention of all the stakeholders and say, this is what should be happening. We know there's been this national movement. We should all be doing this differently. And so they reached out to me for materials. I've sent them materials, and some of them have made their own motions, but it's very hard to get a change from this is the way we've always done it in a lot of these counties. And it's difficult as the lawyer to feel like, well, I'm the only one doing this, and, you know, people don't really understand why we're making this change. And then I feel like that, you know, there's other lawyers who just don't know what's happening, so it just depends on who your lawyer is, whether or not you're shackled or not shackled. And I just don't think that's the way that it should be, and I feel like it can impact our relationship with our client if we're not making these motions. But, you know, if you don't make them in a certain time, maybe the court won't hear it. So there's just so many reasons why, as a lawyer, having a clear policy across the state for everyone to know that all kids are going to be considered safe, you know, unless there's some reason to believe otherwise, is just so important and will make, you know, our relationship with our clients better and will make it easier for the courts. So I just ask that you grant this petition. I'm very excited about the prospect of this change. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Donald. By the time we get to Judge Gonzalez, she's going to be in tough shape, I think.
good morning, Justices. I will be extremely brief. I do not want to be the one who will snatch defeat from the jaws. So I will just say this, and I'm not even going to adjust the podium because I know Judge Gonzalez is behind me, so I'm trying to save time as well. The one thing about this rule that at least indiscriminate shackling that really bothered me while I was on the bench was just how arbitrary it was. Because essentially, if you were in detention and brought into court, you would be shackled. That very same kid could make the appearance a day or two later and be out of custody and not be shackled. Nothing has changed, other than the kid was brought in through the back door. So, I really urge you to support this rule and to approve it. But if you have any questions of me, I'm here. I do remember, actually, I've been on the bench long enough to know, remember when we didn't have shackling, the pre-shackling days. So, but any questions?
Well, that comment raises a question.
Okay.
When did we move from not shackling to shackling?
Well,
date you, Judge Song.
Well, actually, it stems from an incident in Milwaukee County, LaRon Ball, in which a prisoner was able to get a deputy's gun, and then so from that point on, it was always better to be safe than sorry. And then the courts just sort of gave the decision to the sheriff's office.
And that was in adult court?
That was in adult court, yes.
And it got extended to all the courts based on that incident?
Yes.
So. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. An out-of-stater, I think, right? It's nice to have you in beautiful, balmy Wisconsin today. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you. May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Mary Ann Scally. I am the executive director of the Galt Center, formerly known as the National Juvenile Defender Center. I'm here today to testify in support of this critically important rule that both advances adolescent development and racial justice for the state of Wisconsin. The Galt Center is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting justice for all young people by ensuring excellence in youth defense. We support a national community of advocates. We work with 9 regional centers across the country, so our work is really influenced by the field and what our community of lawyers and advocates with young people across the country. We've been lifting up and advocating for young people's rights for 25 years, and I'm here today to talk with you about this critical piece of work that we began in 2014, a campaign against indiscriminate shackling of young people in courtrooms. Through our work on the anti-shackling campaign, we partner with judges, advocates, policymakers, media, medical professionals, all of whom have shared information and important research on the harms of shackling. We've also seen since 2014 a transformation in how states look at the impact of shackling on young people. So I'm here to provide and grateful for the opportunity to offer 4 additional anchor bolts to the strong foundation that's been laid by the esteemed speakers before me with us today. 1, there is a national trend to end the automatic shackling of young people in courts. 2, the national trend shows us that shackling reform does not increase security risks. 3, the national reform also shows us that shackling reform does actually improve court proceedings, as you've heard from other speakers this morning. And finally, a statewide provision is the most effective way to eliminate automatic shackling. So 1, the national trend to eliminate shackling. We launched this campaign in 2014. At that point, only 13 states had provisions that disallowed automatic shackling in court. Today, 34 states, including D.C., limit or prohibit indiscriminate shackling of courts, while just 16 states do not. States that prohibit indiscriminate shackling of children include every neighboring state of Wisconsin, and 3 of your 4 neighboring states ended automatic shackling through a statewide court rule, as you're considering here today. 2, shackling reform does not increase safety risks. One of the questions we frequently receive across the country when we're looking at reforms such as the one you're considering today is what happens in states where these reforms are actually undertaken? To answer that question, we have collected data and we've conducted a survey in the states where they have engaged in shackling reform. And I can tell you that through these confidential interviews with confidence, that in states that no longer shackle youth, key findings support a presumption against shackling because it does not increase safety risks. 2016 data from 6 diverse states indicate that no evidence of compromised safety for young people
or court staff occurred after ending automatic shackling of youth. They were in urban and rural states. For example, in Miami, they ended automatic shackling in 2006. They collected data from 2006 to 2016. 25,000 children went through that courtroom and appeared in Miami-Dade without court injury or escape. Same in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Connecticut, Clayton County, Georgia, Louisiana. We have data from all of those places. No jurisdiction providing data reported compromised safety due to the unshackling of young people in the courtroom. And in 2021, we conducted this national survey. Participants shared the same reports, and we heard from judges from states across the country, judges who underscored how it changed the demeanor of the courtroom. In Massachusetts, a judge said that being unrestrained in the courtroom where he has presided went virtually seamless. The third point, shackling does actually improve court proceedings for young people. The United States Supreme Court in 2007 disallowed shackling in Deck v. Missouri. If we can unshackle adults, we can unshackle children. And in this decision, they cited the dehumanizing and humiliating impact of shackles. Our 2021 survey underscored three critical things: the increase in young people's well-being, the positive behavior and engagement with judges, as you heard, and an increased capacity to engage with defenders. What our judges and defenders and court stakeholders have said is that what is compelling is that the children and families had more meaningful conversations and better well-being. I was struck by Judge Mitchell's statement at the beginning when he said that the demeanor of the child was broken, who he saw in shackles. The judges who have been engaging in this reform talk about young people being more engaged, actually underscoring the importance of due process. Finally, the statewide method of improving a court rule makes clear that local policies alone are insufficient. With a presumption against shackling, the decision to shackle a child in the courtroom in rare instances in which it's deemed necessary can follow the discretion of a judicial officer. Again, judges and states across the country share examples. In Connecticut, prior to the law change, they had adopted a less formal policy. And what they saw was what's happening here in Wisconsin today, that it's actually inconsistent what's happening to young people. The statewide rule would allow consistent justice to occur for young people across your state. We support this proposed rule, and I will end with Nelson Mandela's statement that there is no greater revelation of the soul of a society than the way in which it treats its children. And this provision today is critically important in Wisconsin's treatment of its children. Thank you.
Thank you. We gave you a few extra minutes for making the plane trip.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Are there questions?
I think you're all set. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time.
Safe travels.
Thank you.
Safe travels to everyone. Jennifer Ginsburg.
Good morning. Thank you. I will be very brief. I've spent the time crossing out all the things I was going to say that have already been said so beautifully. But I did want to just bring out one aspect that hasn't been mentioned yet that I think is important to your considerations. So my name again is Jennifer Ginsburg, and I am here as the chair of the Governor's Juvenile Justice Commission. So the commission is a statewide advisory group that's established by the Federal Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act. And so there's a statewide advisory group in every state. And the role of the group is to advise the governor regarding best practices, to monitor the state's compliance with the elements of the act, and to administer grant funds for promising practices. The commission is a very diverse and broad group of people and represents aspects such as the Department of Corrections, law enforcement agencies. There's a district attorney from Outagamie County, as well as the Public Defender's Office, state government social services, as well as nonprofit social services, including victim advocacy, which is my the role, and nonprofits working with youth in the juvenile justice system. And the commission feels is in unanimous agreement in support of this petition. The commission is very clear that the goals of the juvenile justice system is rehabilitation and community safety, and that shackling doesn't promote either one of those goals. Shackling contributes to the trauma of the children in the court system. It inhibits their ability to participate in the engage with the system and participate and thus achieve their rehabilitative goals. And re-traumatizing our kids certainly doesn't contribute to community safety. So there, I believe, is a letter in your materials from the commission in support of this petition, but I just wanted to emphasize that this diverse group of experts really feel is in unanimous support of this petition. So thank you.
Thank you. Yes, your letter, as well as many other letters, can be found in the binder that each of us have. So
great.
We have the benefit of that as well.
Thank you very much.
Sam Benedict, another familiar face. See, you have this effect on people, Sam.
What's the...
No,
this might be
a real one.
That's not a scheduled time.
This might be where we need to exit.
Just hold on for one second. The marshal is.